I too want to greet you in Jesus' name this morning and welcome everybody who's present. Some of us were not as present as we should have been. It was kind of startling at 25 minutes after 8, what I thought it was, to see cars coming in the driveway, and I just got a little mismuffled out of bed because I thought I had an hour and 5 minutes yet to get her ready. And I didn't know it was daylight saving time. So that was a startling way to wake up or get the day started. That wasn't the start of my day. I started at 5 o'clock, but at least we got some of the things done we needed to do. Thank you for your patience. But there are certain jobs you cannot do in a hurry, and that's one. I tried to get Suzanne to eat her breakfast this morning. I couldn't get that done. I didn't have time for it. So she didn't have that yet. And her mornings are, nothing can be done rapidly. So I feel much better than I did 1 week ago when I stood here. And although this throat still is not 100%. I almost feel like I need to explain to you what I'm doing here today. This is going to be material that is going to be very, very new to a number of you, to most of you. And you're going to wonder where in the world we ever came up with teaching like this. And you're going to think for a while that you're listening to a foreigner who doesn't really belong here. But before we're done, it's my desire to take all these thoughts and reduce them down into a funnel, into Grace Christian Fellowship, so that you can see how some of these principles apply to what God is doing among us here at this very time. And maybe it would help you if I would tell you that recently I received a request to speak at a this will be about a 6, 7, 8 month long course preparing people for third world and less situations, dangerous situations, where the gospel usually is not taught. And the easy places are already taken care of. They're already reached. And so there's a vision there to get 30, 40, 50 young people together and prepare them for extenuating training. So I was asked to bring a series of lessons on what they titled the Incarnational Missionary. It just so happened that this thought went very parallel with things I was thinking about right then. And I decided that I would, though I don't think I'm going to be going to that, accepting that assignment because of things we have to do. But I thought I would take the idea that I would teach in that course and bring it to you this morning. So it's going to be things that you've never heard about. You're going to have a hard job believing that some of these things are true. This will give you a little index into a part of my life that you know nothing about. And I will just have to tell you that to have left this way of living and this way of thinking almost 3 years ago and returned to a place called the United States was a very difficult decision for me to make and has not been easy ever since. And so I'm going to find myself reliving what I used to be doing. I often have trouble when I'm writing a sermon. I have to stop because I can't see anymore because there are too many tears in my eyes to write the next sentence. That happened time and time again, sentence after sentence. But these words are written on this paper. I'm going to write a title on the board. And again, it will need to be explained. And this will not be as lengthy as what you think it might be, because we could talk about this thing for many hours. But we're just going to reduce it here to a few simple thoughts. The Epictetus principle in missions. I'm going to begin this meditation with a few observations that I wish I wouldn't have to make. There are a few of you sitting here that will readily recognize the truth of what I'm going to say. Others, you would probably have never entertained these thoughts in your lifetime. Just a few observations. I have seen mission efforts in several countries that are characterized by the following conditions. And I have six listed here. I'd like you to listen. This will be new material for you, every word from here on. In these missions, the Americans live on what we're going to call the mission property or the mission farm, where English is spoken almost exclusively. You might think that sounds like a good thing, but it's not a good thing. That is a very bad thing. That is the common thing in many, many missions in this world. Number two, the living standard here is decidedly American. Number three, this mission project seems foreign to the local or to the national people. They cannot understand it. Number four, there is mostly American missionary staff in the regular church services, and very few of anybody else. Number five, American staff is almost invariably replaced with other Americans. In other words, your term of service is over, so bring another American in to take your place. That should be a very simple view to figure out. That's a very common practice. So with having heard those things, number six should be easy to understand. After 40 years of such a mission, there are usually no national or native ordinations. My question is, have any of you ever seen that model in the New Testament? The answer is, it is not there. It is absolutely not there. Where did that come from? Who invented that? Why do we do that? The Epictetus principle in missions. So stop right there. The Epictetus principle at Grace. That's where I'm going. You can't figure that out, but you'll be able to see that after a while. Open your Bibles to John chapter 1. The incarnational missionary. These two words, incarnation, incarnational, there's a word. Let's put that word right there. Let's put the word autochthonous over here. The two words are very, very similar in what they mean, except for this difference. When you talk about incarnation, you're talking about a process that the person goes through that goes from here to here. When you talk about autochthonous, you're looking at it from the point of view of the local national scene that watches all this happen. So the incarnational thought is what Jesus went through, or what the Logos of God went through when it became a man. And the autochthonous idea is what local people recognize when they see how this is working out with this new presence, this stranger, this unknown person suddenly in our midst. So John 1:14 says, "And the Word was made flesh, that was incarnated, and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. The glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." Philippians chapter 2, these are verses that are very familiar to you, but apply to this subject in one way or another. Philippians 2:7, but made himself of no reputation. That is, Greek would say he emptied himself. Whatever was in there, he emptied it out. And took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. You see, so he went from this to this. And he did that by choice. That was voluntary. He did that. 1 Timothy 3:16. Without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on the world, received up into glory. 1 Corinthians 9. These verses all apply to what we need to say or have said. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 20 to 22. Unto the Jews I became a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. In other words, he became like the people he was trying to help. Mark chapter 1. You see, Dale, you're doing a lot of jumping around here. Well, these verses are all in the Bible. Mark chapter 1, verses 37 and 38. He had been out praying early in the morning, as Brother Hillel told us last week. And so the disciples wondered where he was. 37 says, and when they found him, they said unto him, all men seek for thee. Notice his answer. And he said unto them, let us go into the next towns, that I may preach there also, for therefore came I forth. We have something very similar to that, not applied to Christ this time, but to us in Romans 15. I'd like to read here verses 20 and 21. This is now Paul expressing the same thought that Jesus just shared there in Mark 1. Yea, so have I strived to preach the gospel not where Christ was named, lest I should build upon another man's foundation, but as it is written, to whom he was not spoken of, they shall see, and they that have not heard shall understand. At Grace here, we are acquainted with the miracle of the incarnation. The Logos of God became flesh, became a man, which was the fulfillment of what Brother Lau again said last week. Immanuel, what did he say that means in Hebrew? He took notes on that. No one ever remember that? Immanuel. They put a hyphen after they put El. E-L. Immanuel. What does Immanuel mean? God with us. And so this incarnation was a fulfillment of that promise, God with us. Immanuel, which is God, the L ending, God with us. But most any society has cultural differences. There are differences of wealth, there's differences of status, there's differences of influence. And when Jesus came to this world, when he became incarnate and came to this world, he could have come in on any level he wanted to, the high religious level. He could have come in on the Sadduceical level. He could have come in on a Roman level. He came in on the lowest possible Jewish level. That's how he came. Born to a very poor family. The evidences of the economic need in that family show up several times in the early Bible record. when Jesus was brought to the temple at a very, very early age for that purification rite, the women were allowed various kinds of sacrifices that they could bring for that. The very, very poor ones could bring a turtle dove. That's what Jesus' mother did. He was just of that category. And so when people made an innuendo about Christ, they called him, "Is not this the carpenter's son?" You get the point there, don't you? Jesus entered the lowest level. "Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, upon a colt, the foal of an ass." Listen to this question. Can there any good thing come out of Nazareth? This is where Jesus was. In Christ, we observe two principles. He became an incarnational missionary. That was one thing. He did so in an autochthonous way. He became an incarnational missionary. He took upon himself a being like ourselves. Not a pretended humility, but true lowliness of mind. He did that, chose to do that. Please don't become a missionary in any other way. Anybody that would like to become a returned missionary should never leave where they are. Don't ever attempt to serve other people in humility and grace if you're looking forward to some recognition for what you're doing. And then, being found in fashion as a man, flesh and blood, he committed himself to live among his people as they themselves lived, spoke the language that they spoke, living standard that they understood. He identified with the common people. So at this point, we have these two terms to learn: incarnation or incarnation principle, where we seek to become like the people that we are called to serve and then to save and to become one of them. And then we have this autochthonous principle, this autochthonous work that Christ did, where we choose to live as they do in the community or in the tribe or in the culture where you wish to present the gospel and plant churches. Now, most of us know what incarnation means. For Christ, it meant that eternal glory and infinitude took on a human body with all of its limitations. That's amazing change. For us today, it means that Christ has become a Quechua or some other ethnicity. For example, Christ has become an inner city tenement dweller. This is very significant. The word autochthonous is a compound Greek word. You all know what this part of the word means here. You're acquainted with the word automobile, which means it travels by itself. It's mobile by itself. Doesn't have to have a horse to pull it. It goes all by itself. That's where the word automobile comes from. This word right here in Greek is earth or soil. But probably the best translation we have for it in the English language is this word. Humus. What the word means is from the same soil. It comes from the same soil. Something that is autochthonous comes from the same soil. It means up from the humus. And of course, that word humus is where in the English language we get our word humble. Lowly, down here, the dirt. We come up out of this dirt. We come up out of this soil. If you're going to Peru, you come up out of the Peruvian soil. If you're down in the Altiplano there where the Quechuas live in this high elevations between 12,000 and 14,000 feet, you're in that same soil. And you can't do there what they can do. You can never keep up with them. You couldn't do anything that they're doing because you don't have enough oxygen to do it. And it'd be a hard job to walk 100 feet. When I was down there and we did a lot of walking in those mountains, the Indians there told us to take our one hand and grab the wrist of our other hand back here behind us, bend forward like this, and then walk. And surprising how that helps you be able to keep on going in that high altitude. And when they carry those heavy loads on their backs, they put a strap around their forehead to this big baskets back here, and they lean way, way front. And this pull, this stays in that position, and this is how they walk. Up from the soil. I'll give you an illustration of what this means. We got our word humble from humus, lowliness of mind, or a low-lying mind. I'd like to give you some examples of what I mean by up from the same soil. If you would visit the Jacob Friesen family, I don't know if they're here this morning or not. I haven't had a chance to see yet who's present here. Are they here? Over there. All right, thank you. If you visit their family and see a coffee bush growing in their house, you know that that coffee is not autochthonous. It does not come up out of Missouri soil or Tennessee soil. It does not come up from that soil. It is not autochthonous. It's artificial. It doesn't belong there. It can be there. For a while it can survive there, but it's not from there. Bananas do not grow in a temperate climate. Oranges do not grow in Alaska. These are not autochthonous things. If that happens, it did not come up out of that soil. It is foreign there. If it's not from that soil, anyone looking on says, this doesn't belong here. Where did it come from? This is foreign. Now, that's all theories, and I'll give you a practical illustration. Our experience with dairy farming in Costa Rica went like this. We moved down from Tennessee. We were dairy farmers. We thought we knew how to make a Jersey cow produce milk. We went to Costa Rica. Here's a farm tractor. Here is a forage harvester. Here's a manure spreader. Here's a self-unloading forage wagon. We built it, the boys and I. We planted corn. We chopped this stuff. We made silage piles. The Costa Ricans all around us had no idea what we were doing. We brought the first manure spreader into the country that was ever there. No one had ever seen one work. Didn't know what it was. Nothing that we did was autochthonous. Except the cow. The cow they understood. They understand a cow. They understand a pail. They understand milking. They know how to do that. We did not Man can't profit with dairying until we threw all the machinery away and did everything the way they did it. So we had one horse, a single axle horse cart, and a wheelbarrow, and we did all our farming with that. And then 30 cows supported the three families. When we did it their way, instead of trying to do it our way. And it was up from the soil. Everything matched what they were doing and fit there very well. I had an interesting visit from a national brother one evening that made a lasting impression upon me and formed at a very early stage my concepts for mission work. This national brother sat there in the house with us and said these words, "Brother Dale, we don't know anything compared with you people. You know how to take mangoes and turn them into a sauce and put them into a jar and you make the jar real hot. And then you take the jar and sit it on a shelf. And 6 months later, you can open that jar and you get mango sauce out of there and you have mango sauce for Sunday dinner. None of us have any idea how to do that. And you can take corn and grind it up small pieces and feed it to your cows, and it makes more milk when they eat that than when ours eat grass or corn that just comes off the field. And you call that silage, and none of us have ever seen that, have ever heard of it, but you know how to do it. You do all these things." And then he said, "Brother Dale, isn't there anything that you can learn from us?" And by the time he had those words said, I was so small, I didn't know what to do. I realized how wrong, I realized how impossible it's ever going to be to present the lowly Christ of Nazareth to these dear people. I knew that it would never work. Yes, there's something we can learn from you. And so we turned this around. And I allowed them to show me. I allowed them to explain to me how things are done, what we ought to do here. Come and help us to get it done. Help us, show us how to do it. Help us to do it. And the whole future of that church effort changed when that change came. I realized that what I'm talking about this morning changes considerably on the global market when you have fiber optic internet and smartphones. It all that changes to a point, because things that come from America are not as strange, not as unique, not as exciting as what they were before people had access to that kind of information. But if you get to an indigenous community, a tribal group, and we worked a lot among those, this issue is a big stake issue. It's a very important issue. When the American lives on a level unknown locally, he presents himself as a foreigner and often uses the money that is available to help him nudge his neighbor up to a higher living standard, providing work on the mission compound for locals around him, making loans to them, things that you will never see happen in New Testament church planning, but it's extremely common in missions all over the place. It is a general problem in missions for the staff to feel that the locals are being deprived or unjustly living a low standard and need to be helped to improve their status. Of course, they may tend to feel guilty because of their own elevated way of living, So you think maybe we can help justify this if we help the locals a little bit. And again, the locals soon learn something when this happens. They learn that the missionaries owe them what they are enjoying. And some of them have said, if you truly love us, you will provide these things for us. No one ever expected something like that from Paul or Barnabas, but they expected from missionaries in almost every country of the world today. No one expected this of the disciples that Jesus sent out two by two. I'm going to read this to you. It's in Mark, in the sixth chapter. But he sent these disciples out. I'm reading here verses 7 through 10. Listen to what this says. And he called unto them the 12 and began to send them forth by two and two, and gave them power over unclean spirits. Commanded them that they should take nothing for their journey, save a staff only. No scrip, no bread, no money in their purse. But be shod with sandals, and not put on two coats. And he said unto them, in what place soever ye enter into that house, whatsoever place ye enter into a house, there abide till ye depart from that place. And I found out what it's like to go to a strange community and be invited to eat what the tribal people there are eating. To be invited, which for them is an honor, invited to sleep with them on the floor where they sleep, to bathe in their river, to walk their muddy trails. It has this effect. It will make you one of them. That's what happens. This was Christ's purpose for those he sent out. We are well on our way to present the gospel to any culture when the only thing we have to offer them is the gospel we teach and the example of the gospel that we live. When that's all we have to offer, we're in very good condition to help people everywhere, with no exception. And by the way, that teaching the gospel is not effective if they don't see the example of it being lived in our lives. This is one advantage possibly of being a missionary that earns at least a significant part of his living by a work project of some kind that he has. That would be in harmony, a work project in harmony with what your neighbors are doing. Let me give you this very sad illustration. This is very, very sad to me. But we, in Costa Rica, we lost a congregation. When the few Americans that were in that church, are you listening closely? We lost a congregation when the few Americans were in that church shifted their work to stateside internet jobs, which the Spanish members were unable to do. And with these stateside jobs receiving a stateside wage, this made a tremendous change between these Americans and their local national member counterparts. And the church is gone. What was gained in income was lost in the pews. I say that with a very sad heart. But now, from what you've heard so far, you could have expected that result. Such a way of living is not autochthonous. It does not come up from the soil. It puts us on a level our national members cannot reach. And something happens at that point. Of course, I'm going to admit to you that wisdom is needed in a case like this. I was teaching these principles in the state of Tennessee, about 20 years ago, and a young man who was attending the Deer Lodge congregation up here 2 hours from you was present and heard what I said. I was teaching that we eat what they eat. We work when they work. We live in a home like they live in as much as we can. And Johnny Pinkham, George Pinkham's son, took these words to heart. When he went to the Sierra Madres there among the Tarahumara Indians in Mexico, he nearly died there. He decided to follow my advice, a la pie de la lettre, as exactly as he could, and probably exaggerated a little bit. Did just like they did, and his body could not handle it, and he got weaker and weaker and weaker. They thought he was going to die. His parents contacted me. Of course, we lived in Costa Rica, George and Jeannie, and said, "Dale, our son is almost dead. Can you do something for our son?" Ben Sullivan, from the state of Washington, joined our congregation in Marseille in Costa Rica. And it was he that we then commissioned to go to the Miang Indians in northern Nicaragua. He suffered privations there that's just hard to believe. The effort he went to become an Indian, to be a Miang Indian. He was the first white man to learn their language. Here's what he did. He went to town, went somewhere, and bought 6 or 7 shirts exactly alike. Work shirts. And bought 6 or 7 trousers exactly alike. He did that so that when he would change clothing and have a clean set of clothing for the next day, the people among him who were not able to do that saw that he was wearing the same thing he wore yesterday. He didn't want to give the impression he was on a level different from them. That's what he did. He had access to a very high quality American Army backpack that was just built to handle your body and be comfortable, and you could haul tremendous loads with it. It had all kinds of pockets and stuff in there. But he got there and saw how they carry things in their back. He threw it away and got a feed bag and tied a rope from these two corners around to the two corners at the bottom, put his arms through those two ropes, and would put about 100 pounds of weight in there to carry it in the jungles. And this pack was so heavy that these ropes cut into his shoulders. And so he put leaves under there so that he could stand the pain of that pulling on there. Both of these incarnational missionaries married Indian girls, the two boys I just told you about. Gordon Wanger, in the Altiplano of Peru, thought that he and all of his family would die there. He told me that no American can live at that altitude. We did lose several children because of altitude in that country. There's several different families in several different locations. And what I said on one of those occasions, I will say here this morning, I said, as a child was being buried, "This is not a burial. This is seed sowing time." That's what I said. I'm trying to show you this is very close here. Everything I'm saying, I'm reliving. There's a concept in transcultural church planning which is called bonding. If you don't know what bonding is, it works like this. We We made the stupid mistake in Costa Rica of taking a Brahma heifer and breeding her to a Jersey bull. Now, if you want to learn something from a erstwhile failing dairy farmer, please hear me. You don't ever do that. The Brahma heifer is bad enough, but put a Jersey bull blood inside that animal that's born, you have an amazing going on here. So she turned out to be a heifer, so this animal grew up and she was wild as could be, and then she was going to have a calf, and she took off way out in the jungle and had her calf out there by herself, and no one knew where it was. So I decided for breakfast I'll go out there and see if I can find that calf. Here's ignorance personified. Here's ignorance wearing a pair of boots. So I'm out there, and there's some back there with long ears. And she sees me coming, the mama. I look around a little longer, and sure enough, there's the calf. The mother backed away. And I walked up to the calf. The calf started sucking my fingers. And I walked away, and the calf followed me. And the mother, and I knew I'm going to have a hard job getting out of there. What I did was I bonded myself to that calf. And the calf thinks that I'm mama. That's bonding. Mistakes you make that you can't go to school to learn how to prevent it. There's only one way to learn it. Bonding. Bonding explains how someone who's new to a community can endear himself or herself to the locals and thus become one of them and one with them. It can happen in several ways. One way to bond yourself to a target community is to learn the language from them. Another is to allow them to provide you with what you need as you live among them. Trust them and they'll trust you. Allow them to serve you. This erases the idea that the gringo is superior. Christ lived this way when he was on this earth. He followed this principle here. Let me show you how he did it. He asked for a drink of water from someone who was very, very unlikely to give him one. He borrowed a boy's lunch. He accepted meals in homes of very, very wealthy people. He borrowed a donkey. He borrowed a boat. Remember, it says there that you're going to find an upper room that's already furnished. He borrowed a tomb. For Suzanne and I, our bonding experience in Costa Rica happened in a very unusual way, something I would not have expected, but at 7 weeks of being there, our son died. 15 years old, a couple weeks from 16. The funeral did not cost us anything. Neighbors got together and built a coffin with some boards that they found there. People brought food for a meal. Funeral was over. Everyone was waiting for us to get on the next airplane and get back to the north. We didn't do that for a simple reason. We couldn't afford to do it. Suzanne and I and the rest of the children could not afford to leave Costa Rica, so we stayed. When they saw that we stayed, they accepted us like they probably never would have otherwise. Again, and as you now already know, one of the most foreign things that we take to developing nations is wealth. This is one of the most significant problems and missions and sets us apart from our fellows. Jesus and his disciples did not have this hindrance. Roland Allen, who was an Episcopal priest, wrote a book titled Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours, and in there he has an entire chapter, one of the longest chapters in the book, on the place of finance in missions. One of the reasons, and I hesitate to say this in a pulpit here at Grace. I thought about whether I should say this or not, so I kept it out of my notes. But one of the reasons why Jehovah's Witnesses are as effective in developing countries as what they are is because when you go among them into their communities where they live or where they have a kingdom hall, where they have their services or their gatherings, you'll find no gringos there. No money is coming to them from the States or from anywhere else. They're doing everything they do with local people. Their locals spread on to other locals. That's how they do. Money is a major problem in missions. The incarnational missionary, with a Tocantins church planting idea, begins like this. They begin with a Christ-like attitude toward the national population. I stop there. I've worked with missionaries, or maybe they're not missionaries, maybe they're just people from another country that were out traveling and decided to land at a local airport and live there for a while. But who cannot trust nationals, virtually cannot stand them, suspicious of them. They're just here to take advantage of you. The project is over. The incarnational missionary who has a plan to start an autochthonous church plant begins with a Christ-like attitude towards the national population. We are not in competition with the nationals. We are not superior to them. We are not condescending down from above, down to their level. Nor are we esteeming ourselves better than they. We cannot live as they do without loving them first. I'd like you to listen this morning to some things that Jesus said about some very, very unlikely people. I'd like for us at Grace to have this attitude towards the people we meet. I'd like you to listen to these words are almost startling. Jesus broke all the rules of Judaism to say the words that I'm going to say to you this morning, but Jesus said them, I didn't. I'm going to give you a few quotes. Jesus said this about a Roman centurion. I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. Jesus said these words about a publican. For as much as he also is a son of Abraham. Jesus said this of a foreign and pagan mother. Heathen mother. He said to her, great is thy faith, be it unto thee even as thou wilt. That's when her daughter, demon-possessed, was healed in Matthew 15. I want you to listen to this. Jesus commissioned a man to be a hometown missionary within hours of his being delivered from demon possession. You have that in Luke chapter 8, verse verses 38 to 40, where he told the Gadarene demoniac, when he was sitting and clothed in his right mind, and wanted to get along with Jesus and get back on his boat and go along with him and stay with him for a while. And Jesus said, look, you go back to your hometown and tell these people what great things I've done for you. And the Bible tells us in that last verse that I just said, in verse 40, it tells us how effective that man's missionary effort was. And when Jesus came back there, the people came to receive him because of this man's testimony. He was just delivered from demons no more than a few hours prior to that. That was the confidence Jesus had in people, the way he related to people, the attitude that he had towards others. This is a secret to the life of Christ. Love, trust, respect, and acceptance are the vital keys to autochthonous missions. Without this, all we're doing is legally trying to follow someone's church planning course. That's all we're doing. This is how God became flesh. And this is how Jesus came to a Jewish community in Galilee. And this is how this faith began that you and I are embracing today. Now we close with some practical applications for Grace Christian Fellowship. You say, well, now, Dale, wait a minute. None of these principles apply to us. They all apply to us. I'd like you to listen just for a few more minutes and see if I can help you understand how this can be and must be at Grace. We have families coming in among us, moving in among us. Some have done that. Others are planning to do it. We will tell you more about that later. But we have families coming in among us. I think all of you know that. And what this does for us is the following. It gives us an opportunity to allow their diverse culture, allow their unique historic background to contribute to the rest of us. Indeed, we will find out when they get here that they have something to teach us. We don't only have things to teach them. I wonder if, I won't mention anyone's name here. If you're new to this congregation and you're sitting here listening to what I'm saying, I want you to know that you have something to teach me and something to teach the rest of us, and your contribution is needed here. That's the way Christ lived. These dear people that are coming in among us, are you listening this morning, are neither strangers nor guests, but are a vital part of the household of faith at Woodbury. And we must understand that that's the way it is. We invest confidence in the work and presence of the Holy Spirit in the life of each one of them, including some who may apparently have some significant needs. But we have needs also. When Barnabas went to Antioch, the first thing he saw there was the grace of God among these people. And when these dear families come in among us, these dear youth that are coming to Grace, we should be able to recognize the grace of God in them. If we are awake spiritually, we'll be able to see that. Each brother and sister that comes here and is here has an opportunity to shine within this brotherhood. Now here I'm going to mention a name. I did not ask him permission to do it, nor his parents. But I want you to listen to what I'm going to say. None of you at Grace have ever seen Mark Gingrich standing before us here in the pulpit bringing a devotional meditation. Now you're listening. Now I've got your attention. But he has a chance to shine just like everybody else does. If you want to see him shine, I'll tell you what you do. You go to the next community wood splitting and find out what happens there. Everybody has the right to shine in this church. If we do not invest confidence in one another, neither will we inspire their faith in God, because those two come together. When we mistrust, wait for them to improve, wait for them to grow 5 inches or gain 10 pounds, they will not develop faith in God that way. But we invest confidence in them and say, it's going to work out fine. We like what we're seeing. This is going well for you. The many needs still remain. That's reciprocal. Our confidence in them, their faith in God. Yes, we should be willing to kindly correct wrongs in one's life. But we dare not mistake cultural differences for spiritual deficiency. The Pharisees were continually misjudging people, assigning them wrong motives, what they were trying to do. Jesus never did that. I guess I'll end this morning with a few words from my son. He has never preached in this pulpit, but there's a sentence here that maybe we ought to hear. It certainly is the heart of an incarnational missionary, and certainly is an apocalyptic way to start a church and to work and relate with people. He said, Daddy, none of us should ever lose sight of our smallest moment. If we remember who we are, we'll help somebody else as they're in difficulties. These thoughts, I trust this morning, will help us bless the dear people that God is bringing to us. And may his will be done here, and may his name be glorified. And may in this way his will be done in earth as it is done in heaven.